Welcome to SCOTUS Cast, Permanent Lawful Residence and Deportation Relief Edition. Thank you for tuning in. On December 12, 2011, the Supreme Court announced its decision in Judelang v. Holder. This case addresses the policy of the Board of Immigration Appeals regarding when resident aliens convicted of certain offenses may apply to the Attorney General for relief from deportation. Prior to 1996, denial of entry to aliens who had not been admitted to the United States was described as exclusion, while the removal of aliens already admitted to the United States was termed deportation. In certain circumstances, a provision of immigration law allowed the Attorney General to grant relief to aliens in exclusion proceedings, but this provision did not apply to similarly situated aliens in deportation proceedings. The Board of Immigration Appeals would nevertheless make relief available, but only if the basis for deportation was substantially equivalent to an analogous grounds for exclusion. This was known as the comparable grounds rule. Here, petitioner Judelang was subject to deportation and denied the opportunity to seek relief because the board determined that his underlying offense was not comparable to any of the possible grounds for exclusion. In an opinion delivered by Justice Kagan, the Supreme Court reversed, holding unanimously that the board's comparable grounds rule was, quote, arbitrary and capricious, end quote, under the Administrative Procedure Act. To discuss the case, we have Jeffrey Pojanowski, who is a professor at the University of Notre Dame Law School. As always, the Federalist Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues. All expressions of opinion are those of the speaker. And now, Professor Pojanowski.
So the case we're talking about today is Judelang versus Holder, which was argued on October 2nd and decided unanimously on December 2nd. Reversing a Ninth Circuit ruling in favor of the government. The question involved here concerned two provisions of the Immigration and Nationality Act. Now, this is a pretty technical background to this case, and I'm going to try to make it as clear as possible. But the basic distinction, it concerns two ways in which an alien can be removed from the United States. The first under the statute is called exclusion. And exclusion is when an alien is denied entry into the United States. It could be the first time coming to the United States, or it could be on a return trip. The other alternative is deportation, which is when an alien is removed from the United States. Now, why do we care about this? Well, there are two separate procedures under the Act for these two different ways of being removed from the United States. And the exclusion procedure basically concerns a list of offenses that precluded entry. But under the statute, the Attorney General had discretion to waive exclusion unless the alien was a threat to national security or had engaged in international child abduction. Basically, almost in every case, the Attorney General has discretion to kind of waive exclusion and let the alien into the country. Deportation, however, didn't explicitly provide for a waiver and dealt with a different set of offenses that triggered deportation. Now, this created an anomaly. Given the different set of offenses and the different waiver provisions, an alien's ability to stay in the United States or reside in the United States could depend on the contingency of whether he was in deportation or in exclusion, with those trying to re-enter the United States better off than those who were residing there. So the federal government, dating back to a decision by then-Attorney General Robert Jackson, has held that deportation proceedings should also have a waiver, even though the statute does not provide for it. But then the hard question, and this is what the court was addressing, was how do you apply the waiver, given that there's two different sets of offenses that trigger deportation and exclusion? Now, one approach that the government has taken in the past and is more generous is to ask whether the alien would qualify for a waiver under exclusion. So in that case, the alien would almost always qualify for consideration for a waiver, since the list of offenses has some very broad ones, including crimes of moral turpitude. So unless the alien was a national security threat or a kidnapper, he or she would have the right to at least ask the Attorney General to consider waiving exclusion. The second approach, which the government has adopted more recently and in this case, is what they call the comparable grounds rule. In other words, does the relevant deportation offense have a close analog to the exclusion offense? So if you think of the two lists as Venn diagrams, you'd say, is there a sufficient kind of overlap between the two offenses? So, for example, both lists have offenses relating to trafficking controlled substances that would qualify, while the deportable offense of sexual assault on a minor is also a crime of moral turpitude. The exclusion basis of moral turpitude is much wider than sexual assault, so it would be insufficiently analogous. So they wouldn't consider a waiver in those circumstances. So adding another layer of complexity, Congress has since amended the Immigration and Nationality Act to basically provide limited relief for both excludable and deportable aliens. The pre-1996 puzzle, however, is still a live question because the Supreme Court has held that the elimination of the discretion is not retroactive. So aliens with criminal convictions prior to 1996 still fall under the old regime, and the same problem applies. Which brings us to Judulang. Now, here we have a native of the Philippines who is a lawful permanent resident since 1974, and he pleaded guilty to a crime in 1988. In 2005, he also entered a guilty plea for theft, which led to deportation proceedings. And so the relevant question was whether he could qualify for a waiver for his pre-1996 guilty plea. Now, the Board of Immigration of Appeals held he could not. The BIA, which had adopted the comparable grounds rule in 2005, applied it here and found that his deportable offense of voluntary manslaughter was not sufficiently analogous to any of the exclusion grounds listed under the exclusion part of the old statute, so he was not eligible for a waiver. The Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals upheld this decision, and in doing so, they were in line with the First, the Third, and the Sixth Circuits, who've accepted the comparable grounds rule, but against the Second Circuit, who rejected it. The Supreme Court granted cert and reversed, siding with the Second Circuit against the Ninth, the First, the Third, and the Sixth. Now, the court did not express a view about whether exclusion and deportation had to turn on the same grounds. Its holding instead rested on its conclusion that the comparable grounds method was arbitrary and capricious, thus in violating the Administrative Procedure Act. Both exclusion and deportation categories, the court explained, contain a slew of offenses, but the two lists do not appear to be drafted in light of each other, and the deportation offenses are not systematically more serious than exclusion offenses. Thus, the mere fact that an alien's offense falls into an overlap of these two slews of offenses bears no relation to whether an alien merits consideration of a waiver. To put it another way, the court saw this no more rational than deciding whether or not both the exclusion and deportation offense have an odd number or even number in their subsection. If the government wants to limit deportation waivers, the court explained, it must choose a non-arbitrary method of filtering these waivers. So what do we make of this case? First, I guess a kind of interesting docket point. Why would the court rule on a complicated statutory question that will eventually become irrelevant? And remember, this only concerns aliens with pre-1996 criminal convictions. The justices raised this question at argument and were told that several hundred cases would be affected by this ruling. So I just want to make a brief three cheers for accepting cases that are complicated, not sexy, but still divide federal appellate courts in a way that affects a lot of people's lives one way or the other. In a time where the court grants 80 or so cases a year, I think this is a great thing for them to be doing. Another odd little factor about this case is here we have unanimous reversal of the Ninth Circuit, which is quite common, but here in a case in which the government won below in a quasi-criminal proceeding, and in a case in which the Ninth was in the majority side of a circuit split, this is hardly a common occurrence for a court that's usually reversed for siding with criminal defendants. Getting onto the administrative law points in terms of administrative law and statutory interpretation, Judulang is also an odd case in that both the government and the alien are defending a policy that is at once governed by a statutory regime that the Attorney General administers and at the same time is completely detached from the text of that statute. A very plausible reading of the Act precludes any waivers for deportation. By allowing waivers in the deportation setting, the government exercises discretion to depart from the text of the statute, but in a way that benefits a regulated party and does not burden other regulated parties who could potentially challenge the departure. So the question is whether the government has been reasonable in its departure from the text. Accordingly, we have the government arguing that its approach should prevail since by allowing fewer waivers, it is less a departure from a statute that does not seem to allow any waivers at all. But Justice Kagan, who wrote the unanimous opinion, says, no dice. If we're playing in a text-free zone, government, you need a better reason than simply creating fewer results in conflict with the text you're ignoring. In the bigger picture, what can we draw from this, what one might describe as a bit of a squib of a case? First, the case may offer some insight on the intersection of arbitrary and capricious review and Chevron deference. Now, as admin law junkies know, the first step of Chevron is whether the statute is ambiguous. If it is, the court takes the second step of asking whether the agency's construction was reasonable. The court found Chevron inapplicable here, but explained that even if the two-step doctrine did apply, the decision would be no different. That was because, the court explained, the second step of Chevron is in substance no different than arbitrary and capricious review. Now, a number of scholars have argued that very point, but the court appeared to reject that equivalence in its famous 2005 Brand X decision. Here, a unanimous court, albeit in dicta, embraces this equivalence between Chevron Step 2 and arbitrary and capriciousness. In doing so, they cited last term's unanimous Mayo Foundation decision for that proposition. This might be read as understanding Chevron as an on-off switch, in which all the statutory interpretation takes place at step one, And then once the text is sufficiently unclear, we move into a step two that concerns policy discretion alone. Now, this inference is bolstered by the court's rejection of the government's argument that a more narrow departure from the text should prevail in what is essentially step two. Now, I don't think this reading of the case, that textual inferences fall off the table at step two, is a necessary one, and I don't think it's the one the court should pursue. Certainly, a textual interpretation that is plausible or probable should have some weight in deciding whether an agency's policy choice is lawful, even if the interpretation is not strong enough to satisfy step one. Here, I think the odd situation of a government and a regulated party agreeing to ignore text distinguishes Judelang from the run-of-the-mill case. The government cannot both suspend textual belief and at the same time justify its decision in terms of textual fidelity. A final point that struck my eyes was the court's treatment of the question of administrative consistency. The government argued that it should prevail because the comparable grounds rule had a long pedigree, and thus was prohibitive of what the statute required. This struck me because my colleague Randy Kozel and I recently published an article titled Administrative Change in the UCLA Law Review. And there we address whether and how a court should weigh agency consistency or inconsistency in reviewing administrative action. And here the court showed hostility to the notion that consistency carries much force on its own. The unanimous opinion by Justice Kagan stated that an arbitrary policy is no better simply because it was longstanding. Further, assuming that consistency was relevant, the court worked reasonably hard to show a pattern of inconsistency, including reliance on a handful of unpublished BIA administrative decisions. The overall thrust of the BIA's practice did seem to favor the comparable offense rule, but a handful of deviations and departures prevented the government from using consistency as the lever. Justice Stevens, the leading advocate on the court for giving deference to longstanding administrative practice and contemporaneous construction, departed from the court, and his successor, Justice Kagan, seems more sympathetic on this score to the views of Justice Scalia, who would give little weight to longstanding practice in its own right.
Thank you for listening to this episode of SCOTUS Cast. For more episodes of SCOTUS Cast, as well as audio and video of past Federalist Society events, please visit our website at www.federalistsociety.org/multimedia.